welcome back to Doing It, the Sex and Relationships podcast, where sex has never been so nerdy, with me, your host, Hannah Witten. This episode, I am joined by the incredible Luna Matatis. Luna is a sex and pleasure educator with over 15 years of experience teaching sex and empowerment workshops. She teaches a wide range of topics, including threesomes, BDSM, and sexual confidence. Luna also hosts the Plug podcast, an anal sex podcast by B-Vibe. And another reason her name may feel familiar, Luna is the creator of the term Peg the Patriarchy, which was all over the news after last year's Met Gala, but more about that later. Luna is such an important voice in the sex positive sphere and is doing such great work around helping people grow their sexual confidence and explore kink. So I knew this would make for a very juicy chat, and oh boy, was I not disappointed. We talked all about how to build your sexual confidence through personal exploration or playing stripper music in the shower like Luna does. We also spoke about the interaction of race and kink, from the frustration of how blind people are regarding race in kink spaces, the delicacy of power in interracial dynamics, and how to engage in race play in an ethical way. We also spoke about all things anal, from Luna's thoughts on why pegging is becoming more popular, what anal training is, the importance of caring for your butthole, and what active receiving looks like in butt play. We spoke about the pros and cons for Luna when Cara Delevingne and Dior appropriated Luna's own work, our shared love of the sex education Baba Ganoush dirty talk sex scene, and Luna shared some really helpful tips for dirty talking with more confidence. I loved my chat with Luna so much. It was both so fun and insightful. I learned loads about the dynamics of race and kink and all about butt stuff. Please note, we do talk about racism and race play in this episode, so do bear that in mind before having a listen, and as always, please take care of yourself. As usual, you can find more info and links to everything we talked about in this episode in the show notes over at doingitpodcast.co.uk, and please let us know what you think over on our Twitter or Instagram, which is at doingitpodcast. And if you liked this episode, please give us a rating and review over on iTunes and Spotify. It is really appreciated. And without further ado, here's my chat with the incredible Luna Matatis. Luna, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited just like to get real into all of these juicy topics with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's going to be real juicy. It'll be good.
Oh, yes. In like all of the senses of the word juicy, I think.
Yes.
So to kick us off, I wanted to talk a bit about like sexual confidence, because in loads of your sex education work, so much of it is around kind of really getting to know yourself and being, becoming like a sexually confident person. And I was curious about what your journey has been like. Have you always been a very sexually confident person, or was that a process?
That's such a good question, because no. And it also, it varies. I mean, I could have great sexual confidence on Tuesday, and then, you know, by Wednesday or Friday, I don't like myself again. And I think that was something that was so important along the journey, that I thought there was going to be this moment where I decided to work on my confidence and I would arrive at this platform of confidence. That's not true. And it really started for me. I was I didn't grow up in a sex positive household. I really didn't have a lot of access to things in the same way that maybe we have access to more information today. And so it was a journey of body shame. It was a journey of sexual shame. It was a journey about all these voices and narratives in my head that had told me things about sex and sexuality that really didn't suit me. And so I was married for about 10 years. And when I got divorced, I very much was determined to fall in love with myself. I was like, I lose myself in relationships. I make it all about the other person. And I had lost connection to any sort of erotic, personal, intimate relationship to myself. And so that was the beginning. That was the beginning of many different tries at sexual confidence. And what's really helped me is recognizing that everyone struggles with this. Everyone struggles with the same things.
Yeah, that's so true. And like, I love you saying that it's not like a, and now I'm a sexually confident person, and then that's me for the rest of my life. And I think also we can fall into the trap of like seeing people like yourself online and thinking, oh, well, she must be a super sexually confident person. But like you said, like we're all kind of on our own journeys and like have good days and bad days as well. And like, we don't have to share all of that stuff as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think people think that sexual confidence is a look, a pose, a way of being. And
like actually aesthetic.
Yes, an aesthetic. Everyone wants to look good while they're doing sex. And the thing is like, sex is beautiful and it's ugly. You know, bodies are beautiful and they're disgusting. So it's really not about that. For me, it became about feeling this removal of self-judgment in my erotic experiences. So this sense of belonging in my erotic experiences, that I deserve pleasure, that I deserve to also be empathetic with my partner's pleasure. And that helped me feel less worried about what I look like in bed.
Mm-hmm. That I love that. Just like removing the judgment from it of like, especially because we can be so judgmental of ourselves and our bodies and desires. So to try and kind of like talk about sexual confidence and like wrap it up in a neat bow, like what are some of your kind of like top tips for people? Obviously, like, not all of these will be universal, but kind of like, where can people get started if they're like, I want to be more sexually confident?
There's many places for people to start. And I think my favorite ones to recommend are looking at your own erotic desires. You know, where do you feel discomfort? Where do you feel embarrassment? Do you even know what you like? Are you like, well, maybe there's stuff out there and I just don't know about it. So start reading erotica, start thinking about your masturbation fantasies, start having conversations with your partners about their fantasies. This can help reduce the shame of asking for what we want. We want the things that we want, and there's all this noise around, ugh, like you shouldn't like that, or that makes you a slut, or this is going to make you demanding, or, you know, a pervert. And so I think people carry a lot of that shame into their sexual experiences. So it's hard to actually enjoy the things we like. And then I think the next biggest one is to start feeling your body move and enjoy being a body just for fun. So I love putting on a sexy playlist in the shower and I'm just like a stripper in the shower, or, you know, right? So anything that kind of gets you into what your body feels, what it hears, what it, you know, tastes, what it, you could have a sensual experience eating a burger, you know, really like, Don't eat it in front of Netflix, or, you know, like really focus on what it tastes like and what it looks like. So those are two big ones that I think really help us.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. The just kind of like being free with your body and all of that. I often think about how we sometimes we try and steer away from like the performance of like sex in our bodies and more around the experience of it. But on the flip side of that, sometimes I really love the experience of pretending to perform, especially when I'm on my own and like putting on a performance for myself, because that feels very like low pressure and low stakes, because it's like in private.
Yes. Yes. You get to just be your own sort of playful performance for nobody but yourself, just because it feels good. And when we look at like what we were like when we were kids, we moved a lot because it just felt good. It was fun. Yeah. You just rolled around because it was fun.
I was literally about to bring it back to childhood as well, because I mean, I can't speak for everybody else, but I was like, I was the kind of kid who like pretended to be a pop star in front of her mirror. And so like, I want to like bring that kind of energy to my like adult sexuality in terms of like me by myself in front of my mirror, like like performing being like this sexually confident woman or something.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, more play. We need more play.
Yeah, I love play. Yes. Well, actually, speaking of play, so you are a kinky person and you talk and educate a lot on kink. I would love to chat more about that. Like, you host this monthly discussion called Race and Kink, and I was curious about kind of like what kind of things come up in that. What insight can you give us into that that intersection between race and kink.
Ooh, yes. That series actually started in 2020 when the world was really watching what was happening in the US with racism. Mm-hmm. And I was just so annoyed that our kinkster community sort of felt that, you know, kink is separate and we shouldn't be talking about politics and kink. And, you know, the personal is political and our pleasure is a revolution. And so when we can't separate that. I can't stop being brown just because I want to spank somebody. You know, it's really all integrated. Yeah. And so we opened up the space to be able to talk about how do we dismantle racism and racist behaviors at the institutional level within kink. So that means, you know, who's running the festivals, who gets shown in latex, you know, what kinds of retailers are selling what. And largely it looks the same. You can Google any kink festival and you're going to see the same kinds of people and they don't look like me. And we also wanted to have people have an opportunity to have discussions around interpersonal things. So if you like fantasies that might feel that there's a power dynamic that could be influenced by racial dynamics or gender dynamics, you know, how do we get into pleasure and create safe erotic spaces emotionally and physically that also recognize that we are people coming in with a lot of systemic baggage, right? All this stuff is learned. And for people who have interracial partners or they're kind of also wanting to navigate dynamics that maybe don't include things like race play, but that could show up, you know, how do we actually have those conversations? Our sexuality and our eroticism isn't separate from a lot of the other types of feels that might be really uncomfortable in things like racism or sexism.
Yeah. And you kind of like mentioned like race play and stuff. And so like there are kinks that very much play on like racist dynamics. And I was wondering what your thoughts on like of people exploring those and like the also like the fetishization of like BIPOC people based on their race. And like if that is something that you experience, how can you make like your kink that maybe like involves race something that is like respectful and mutually pleasurable and agreeable and not like for like and it not be this like fetishization, I guess? Are there ways that that can be done?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think fetishization is a really big one where we make assumptions about what people might like or what they want to be treated like or how they want to be celebrated based on just sort of their racial dynamics. So BBCs or, you know, where we fetishize Black men a lot or we fetishize Asian women. And I think the important thing is to remember, too, is that a lot of the porn dynamics that we're getting these fantasies from, they act as if there's only two races, right? So there's like an ebony category and then there's interracial, it's just all white on black. And so we also wanted to say like, hey, like a lot of these fantasies and the ways that we've seen them actually maybe don't even meet the possibilities, the infinite possibilities of the way that we could express this. Race play tends to be about power dynamics. And so some kind of power exchange is happening. So anytime you're doing that, you really need to be very clear about what's on the menu. So what language, what vibes, you know, are we talking cruel? Are we talking nurturing? Are we talking adoring? Are we talking humiliating? And having a lot of discussions beforehand and during. It's not sort of, we can say, oh, you agreed to this and now you did it and you don't like it. So, you know, we move on. No, we actually have to break this down because you're a person first and then a kinkster second. Even if those things are intertwined, there's so much of our humanity that has to be almost contained within this erotic space for it to be safe. So that's things like the containment is boundaries. The containment is a safe system. The containment is a debrief, aftercare. What are we doing after this happens? How do we put ourselves back together?
Yeah, the aftercare is like such a huge part of it as well, because like you said, like you're a person first. And so like if you kind of like are stepping out of that for a scene briefly, how do you then like make sure you ground yourself back into your humanity and your play partner's humanity and all of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think people have different varying kind of responses to race play. Some people are like, it's a hard no. You know, and I think there's opportunities for also sexual liberation by doing our fantasies in safe and engaging and consensual ways, in that we get to play with a lot of the darkness that we have have nowhere to put in our day-to-day life. What am I supposed to do with a racist system every single day? So my body maybe is like, hey, let's throw pleasure at it. And race play can happen in many different forms. So I enjoy race play from the perspective of being superior. And so if someone wants to be humiliated, if let's say a white man wants to feel like he doesn't have all the power that he does in his regular day-to-day life, and I get to be some sort of like, you know, goddess, like queen of supreme, you know, then great. You know, that's an exchange where I'm accessing power that I don't have in a day-to-day world, in a space where someone has consented to experiencing that.
Yeah, that's so true. And also, like, kinks are often based on taboos. And so, like, that's also an important thing to acknowledge. And it's all fair enough, like, people who, like, have hard limits and just, like, no, that is an absolute no-go for me. But, like, you know, in some cases, it's like, yeah, we might feel a bit icked, like, out by hearing about some other people's kinks. But, like, that's also kind of the point.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a difference between doing race play in like a public kink event and people don't know what's going on and they could be triggered. And for you and your partner sort of deciding that this is something that we want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like context.
Exactly.
Big part of it. So another thing that you talk about a lot, and this is kind of like how I came across you and your work, is the wonderful world of anal and pegging.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. So I feel like we really need to dive into this and all of your expertise. And I wanted to start with your phrase that you coined, peg the patriarchy, which maybe people have heard. maybe they've heard it. Because Dior and Cara Delevingne wore it at the Met Gala on her outfit. And actually, I Googled peg the patriarchy to kind of like see what would come up. And actually, like the first, like it was all very much about her and the Met Gala. But the first result was an article that was like, hey, this happened, but actually, like, it was coined by this woman and was appropriated here, and like, not, you weren't given credit, basically. And yeah, and I was wondering how you found out about that and like what you thought of it and kind of like the aftermath of it all.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you told me that you Googled and it was, the internet is correct, that I coined this phase in like 2015. And I've been selling it as part of my sex positive merchandise. It's also been kind of this phrase that connected me with other people that were interested in subverting systems by using metaphors of pleasure, by talking about sex as part of some of the actions that we use to experience subversion. And I had been teaching a BDSM class the night that I found out it was appropriated, and I went online all happy to like tell people about my class, and then I saw I had like a million mentions, and I was like, oh god, this is not good. Fucked up or like something like happened, I don't know. and when I saw it, there was this mix of like, oh my gosh, you know, because I think, you know, as a sex podcaster and a pleasurepreneur in this world, we're under so much censorship, so it's so difficult to have the kind of reach that like being mentioned at the Met Gala would give someone. So yeah. I was at first, you know, very shocked that, oh my, I didn't even really know what the Met Gala was. Like, I'm not in the celebrity kind of news. And so I was like, what the hell is this thing? And who's Cara Delevingne? I was like, I don't know any of these people. And, but then when I saw the vest, I was like, oh my gosh, the audacity to like not even change the font to, you know, claim it as her own when like it's been in existence on all my profiles. I own the domain. I own the trademark in Canada. And I was just really shocked. I was shocked that I was shocked and not shocked. I think we've seen this happen before where BIPOC creators get ripped off by, you know, wealthy, usually white people. And, you know, actually feeling that there was such a missed opportunity here to actually, if she wanted to speak to feminism, if Dior wanted to speak to feminism, this would have been a great opportunity to lift up another feminist, to be like, hey, yeah, we love this thing, created this, and Luna has a lot of work on it, you know, go check her out.
Yeah.
So it was very much a David and Goliath situation where I don't have a legal team. I don't have the resources to fight this. And so really a lot of my resources came from the support of the community, people who are tired of seeing BIPOC art be appropriated, people who are tired of seeing messages be distorted by, I'm doing air quotes, you know, sort of white feminism. And so it had its, you know, it's good and it's bad. But overall, I think it was also something very personal for me in that I had to stand behind my art. I also had to navigate as a small business owner, all of these like copycats just like popped up everywhere from Etsy to Redbubble, all these like t-shirt places. And so it was a distraction, but it was also very much about, no, I want to protect my art. You know, yeah, I am the, you know, the David in this situation, but this is something that it's mine, and that it's important that people know where it originated from.
Yeah. What was that process like? Did you kind of just have to go like knee deep in admin?
Yes. You got it. I was knee deep in admin. I had to hire someone part-time to file all of the infringement reports.
Wow,
I had to consult with lawyers because at first I thought maybe there's something that I can do, but trademarks are really also really designed to protect people who can protect them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, having one just doesn't, usually people are, it's not the first time someone has stole something, but usually people are pretty much, you know, kind of doing it as a fandom thing, and they didn't realize it was trademarked. And when I reach out to them, they're great. Yeah. I heard nothing from Dior, nothing from Cara.
Oh, I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they just did what celebrities do, and they were able to kind of wait for it to blow over. And, you know, for me, it's still alive.
Yeah. Do you still hear about it? Do you still get messages or anything about it? Or I guess on like maybe a more positive side, do you think that more people found you because it happened or because you weren't credited originally, you didn't necessarily see like the benefits of that?
Yeah, I think more people definitely know about it because it happened, and more people that I wouldn't have been able to reach through kind of traditional advertising. And then I think there are also places, I had someone send me a screenshot from a French opera that was using it. And I was like, okay, I mean, wow. You know, I know. And so I thought, you know, there's definitely going to be now a tale of Peg the Patriarchy that is detached from me, and that people are going to think Kara came up with it and they're going to mimic her vest. But I think the people who matter to me, the people that want pleasure education, the people that want equity and sex to be connected, you know, they found me. And now I've got this whole new like family of support. And I was just so touched. It was really a good cushion for me during such a stressful time.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the community can be so great in that way, especially because like you were saying before about like the censorship and stuff. So oftentimes like we do have to support each other in those ways because we're like, how else do we get like our work out there?
Exactly.
Things like
exactly.
That. So let's actually dive into pegging.
Yes. Let's do this.
Because on a personal note, something I'm fascinated by.
Cool.
Hypothetically. Have not experienced. But I was wondering, like, why you think it's something that's, like, being talked about more. It's, like, at least in my kind of, like, world, it seems to be becoming more popular. I was just wondering, like, what trends, like, have you noticed? Like, when did you start talking about pegging? And, like, have you seen kind of, like, an interest in it kind of grow or evolve?
Yeah. I actually was around the time when Dan Savage, podcaster and educator, you know, had come up with the term pegging. And so this was in the early 2000s. And I remember reading his column and I was like, peg, what? You know, what is this? What's this thing? And I had no anal experience at that time, no pegging, no strap-on experience. And I was just really curious about it. And I think it's become so much more more of a topical issue now, or something that people are curious about or want education about, because it's anal sex. And anal sex is becoming less and less taboo. It's becoming less kinky. Mm-hmm. It's becoming something that people are interested in exploring, which I think is great. Yeah. I mean, the anus is just another erogenous zone. If you make it kinky, cool. If you don't want it to be kinky, you just want it to be normal sex in a different way, mm-hmm. cool. And, you know, pegging as a term really came up to deal with a lot of the internalized homophobia that cis heterosexual men were dealing with. And so it was a way of kind of giving language to a sexual act that felt very much that was came with a lot of shame because of their gender and their sexuality. And so, you know, we kind of moved beyond that. We know that anyone can have strap-on play, anyone can have anal sex, anyone can give and receive. But pegging mm-hmm. for some people is still a particular fantasy. And so the fantasy right. of a strap-on by someone who is a cis woman for a cis man, that fantasy is okay. I mean, we do that with other fantasies. We do that with dominance. Dominance is just dominance. But, you know, you can be a femdom. You can be a daddy dom. You're putting a different flavor into the activity yeah. for your fantasy.
Yeah. And also kind of like subverting those, like, stereotypes or gender roles that you see playing out in the real world. Not yes. that our bedrooms aren't part of the real world, but yeah, it is that kind of that play, that subversion, that taboo, I guess.
Yes.
So say someone is interested in trying pegging, what is like some advice that you would give them in terms of like pegging itself, but then also like some of the practicalities of like, how do you pick a good harness? How do you pick a good strap on? Like all of that stuff as well.
Yeah. It's like a high gear activity. Yeah. And I think a lot of times people just pick up like a pegging kit that comes with a harness and a dildo and they're like, we're going to do pegging. And you know, that's okay. If you got that, that's fine. But there are better ways to shop for your gear. So I think the first thing to do is talk with your partner. Tell them that you're interested in doing this thing. Are you interested in giving, receiving? You know, what's the vibe for you? Mm-hmm. And if you're the person who's telling your partner that you have this fantasy, tell them more than just, hey babe, I want to do pegging. You know, like you got to talk about like, oh, so I was thinking about you in a position of like giving it to me and I wanted to feel kind of helpless, or I want to feel like taken, or, you know, think about what you want to feel and what you want your partner to experience. That's going to give you more points of connection in the fantasy than just the activity.
Yes.
The activity is usually just the vessel, right? Like yeah. it's just like what we channel our sexiness through.
And then what you're aiming for is the vibes.
Yes, yes, yes. Literally and figuratively. Like, we want the vibes. But with equipment, you know, with dildos, if you're doing pegging, we're usually engaging an area that might have access to the prostate too. So we're looking for, and the anus is a little bit different than the vagina in that it's not self-lubricating, mm-hmm. it's not as easily stretchy. So we might be able to do things with the vagina that we can't do with the anus right away. So when you're looking for a pegging dildo, make sure that your eyes are not bigger than the butthole. We want something that is small. A lot of people have size fantasies. Yeah. You can work your way up there, or you can create an illusion of size. But really, the anus needs a lot of warming up. So if your partner's the one receiving or you're the one receiving, you have to start working with butt plugs and anal masturbation and really try and understand what your body feels like during anal sex before your partner has an opportunity. For harnesses, I think that there's so many different options now. Like we've got pelvic harnesses that are kind of strappy or look like underwear. Mm. Underwear harnesses, I usually don't recommend for beginners unless you want to also use a strap with it, because they don't give as much support. And so you're going to have to hold on to your dildo while thrusting. Okay. There's thigh harnesses, there's hand harnesses, you know, there's all kinds of ways that you don't have to go.
Oh yeah, the thigh ones, it's like wrapped around your thigh. And so someone could like sit on your thigh or, yes.
And it gives you lot more, you know, I'm a plus size person. I have a tummy. If my partner has a voluminous body or a voluminous butt, sometimes the dildo isn't going to be able to reach the hole. So a thigh harness actually also gives you more penetrative power. Your thigh is a lot easier to maneuver than your hips for thrusting.
Yeah. And that also made me think about like disabled people as well. And so just the more options that you have just increases the accessibility in terms of like what positions you may or may not be able to get into if you want to try something like pegging or anal play.
Absolutely. I mean, you're pegging dildo or your pegging cock doesn't have to go on your pelvis, right? We get to play because it's not factory installed, so we can put it wherever we want.
That's so true. What does like anal training look like? What are some of like the kind of like key things that people need to be aware of if like anal play is something that they want to start doing? And like you said, like people's eyes can be bigger than their buttholes, but also people can try and like run before they walk. Yes. So like what are the kind of like the training? I want to see like an anal training montage.
I know. I want to see a little booty like doing like, you know, barbells or something. Like, that'd be so cute. Like, anal training is actually something that sounds like work, but it's also pleasure. It's about like getting to know your body, what it feels like. Like the anus is usually an exit only area. So when we're putting things in it, you know, we're getting the anus has a shitty day job. And so like it's, you know, it's got work that our body is used to certain sensations. And so when those sensations happen, when we're getting penetrated, it can trigger our feelings of, oh my gosh, I'm going to take a dump on my partner. I'm going to, you know, shit the bed. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that we know that that's not happening. Your feces doesn't, your bowel, it doesn't land in the rectum. So the area where we would have that penetration, it's that your poop is way higher.
Yeah. Once your poop is in the rectum, you're already sat on the toilet.
Yeah. This is not the time where you're like, huh, I'm going to anal train and I got to take a dump. You know, that's not, it's not how it works. So you want to start really small. I think butt plugs that have a flared base, a flexible neck, and a curved, really soft kind of top are super important and helpful. And something that's no bigger than your thumb. That's where you should start with anal training. You really can't go bigger than that until you can comfortably take that. Lube is your love language with any kind of anal play. Do not skimp on the lube.
Yeah. Any kind of like specific kind of lube is better for anal, or is it kind of just like water and silicone are just kind of like the ones to generally go for?
Yeah.
Or is anal, like, are there different considerations?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. I think what you're looking for is a long lasting lubricant. So we want to make sure that it's not kind of getting used up. So you will probably have to reapply during any kind of your anal play. People prefer things that are longer lasting, like oil-based lubes, silicone-based lubes, or really thick water-based lubes. So if you've got something that you might not use vaginally, you might want to use it anally, because you're going to have a different bit of a texture to minimize the friction that happens during penetration.
Mm-hmm. I've seen these little like lube applicators for like anal play.
Yes.
Where it's like a little mini syringe, so you can kind of like squirt some lube inside. Are they useful?
I love those. I think they're such an underrated thing. So they're like, you're right. They're lube applicators, lube injectors, and they look like a syringe. And this helps get the rectum way more lubricated than if you were just kind of squirting it on the butthole and trying to push it in with your finger.
I love that. I love just like sex toy accessory, like innovation. Right. Just being like, who thought of that? But also great.
Yeah. Thank you, whoever thought of that. Great job.
Exactly. One of the things that I kind of like to say when it comes to penetration, when it comes to like the anus or the vagina, is that like the anus's job is to like push to like it sucks things up, and the like the vagina's job is to push things out.
Yeah.
And so like that I always like to keep in mind when it comes to like the different kinds of things that you would do with those areas. So like you said, like make sure you have a flared base with your anal toys. And then it makes me think of like Kegel balls and stuff. And like, you know, the vagina's job is to push things out. So like, that's kind of like the whole point of like the Kegel training as well. It's like, how long can you hold this in for, but also make sure you relax. Yeah.
Yes. And you got it. And you also said something so important about this relaxation. And when we're trying a new activity, a lot of times our body is tense, or, you know, we finish our work day and we're like, I'm going to go anal train. And, you know, you haven't gotten yourself in the mood. Like, go to your go-to hotspots. If you want to touch your penis or your vulva, you know, before anal training, get your body body warmed up, because that relaxation is going to facilitate the penetration.
Yeah, that's such a huge piece. And like one of the things that you talk about is like being an active receiver. What does that mean? What does that look like, being an active receiver?
Oh my goodness. So I take my own advice around this, because I forget, when you're in the receiving mode, you're just kind of, you know, you can puddle out, you can feel very soft, maybe nonverbal. Or other people feel that it is sort of insulting or maybe challenging to the person who's giving if we give feedback as receivers. And so you might be shy to give your partner feedback. But being an active receiver is all about giving communication. So saying things like slow down, or go deeper, or can we take a break, or more lube. It's also about nonverbal communication. So you can be active in having your partner hold the penetrating item, whether it's a dildo, a penis, or a finger, and you can bounce back on it. So you control the depth of it, right? Or squatting, you can control the depth of it in that way. And that gives your body this sense of trust that we're not going to push past the signs of pain.
That's so important. It kind of reminds me, this isn't a pegging or an anal sex scene. It's like a doggy sex scene in this book called How to Build a Girl, where our character is like on all fours, and she's reminiscing about the fact that this man had a very large penis. And it's like this comedic scene where she's describing herself like on all fours, like moving around the bed to like get, like to create a bit more distance. if you're the one in the receiving position, like you absolutely can, whether that's like where you place your hands or the position that you're in, be the person who controls like the depth and the speed and the pressure and kind of like all of those things. And I mean, as someone who hasn't been in the like active role in that sense, from at least from observation, it can be hard work for that person as well. And like physically, you know, like, and so like you're also letting them have a bit of a break.
Yes. And you're building their confidence. You're building up their confidence in what they're doing is good, what they're doing is right. I've had people who, let's say they're on their back and I'm pegging them and I ask, hey, are you okay? Is this good? And their face is all squinched up and they're like, oh yeah, it's good, keep going. You know, that's not going to build my confidence. tell me to slow down. It's okay to take breaks. Any kind of burning sensation, if you're the receiver, you need to take a break. That means your tissue is getting irritated. You could be causing, you know, either minor injuries or larger injuries like fissures. And fissures take forever to heal. So avoid the fissures, be good to the booty hole, and just take it at the speed that it wants to go.
Yeah. And that, I feel like that's something that so many people have done, where like their words are saying one thing and their body language and their facial expression are communicating something so different. And I think that just kind of like shows why it's so important with sexual partners to not only like discuss verbally, like, hey, what are you into? What do you like? Da, da, da. But also be like, hey, if you're enjoying something, what does that look like?
Yes.
Or if you're not enjoying something, what does that look like? And so then you can kind of understand their like bodily cues, even if they don't necessarily have the words to kind of describe what it is that they want in that moment.
Yes. I love that language, because I think one of the biggest questions that I get hosting the Plug podcast, which is all about anal pleasure, is that, you know, what happens if I tell my partner, you know, this thing? Or what happens if like my partner wants to go faster than me? What happens if there's poop? What, we're so concerned about these natural things that happen during sex that are going to be potentially detrimental to our care, our love, our relationship. Where am I going to live if, like, you know, I shit on the dildo? Like, this is not going to happen. But that thought tornado is so relatable. And so it's no surprise to me that that's one of the most popular concerns.
Yeah, for sure. So I want to chat about dirty talk as well, because, like, we talked a lot about, like, communicating desires and wants and needs and stuff. And I think sometimes people can get a bit like, oh, that doesn't sound like sexy. But like dirty talk for me is just like such a great way to kind of do all of that necessary consent work, but then also in this really sexy, playful way. And yeah, I think also people have a lot of hesitations or resistance to dirty talk because kind of like back to that confidence piece as well of like not feeling confident enough to it. Have you seen Sex Education and the Baba Ganoush?
Oh, scene? Yes. 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 Oh, my God. I love that show.
I wanted to know your thoughts on that. And then just also like dirty talk in general, because that kind of like storyline between the two teachers and their dirty talk and then them just like hornily screaming Baba Ganoush just to me like epitomized like how you dirty talk doesn't have to be like this really serious thing.
You nailed it. That's what I took away from it too. I think that dirty talk and sex in general, it we underrate how silliness can be sexy. And it goes back to that chat of our conversation around being playful. And the Baba Ganoush is so much about, it actually doesn't matter if you're saying some kind of raunchy script that sounds, you know, very much like porn or uses a lot of like curse words or like very kind of gruff words. If you like that, that's great. But it doesn't have to be like that. And so you can actually make anything sexy by changing your tone, by slowing down what you say and actually lowering your volume. And so that's something that is, you know, really something that you can practice with your partner. You can kind of flirt over dinner and be like, go get me some nachos, you know, and just make it feel like, you know, right? Like do that and then giggle about it.
Pass me the salt,
nachos,
baby.
Right? Yeah. Extra cheese, you know? Yeah. That's actually the homework that I give my dirty talk participants in my class is to dirty talk a menu to their partner. And so like, or a recipe or something. Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Because I think sometimes we get so in our heads when it comes to sex and dirty talk that we're constantly like, it's that judgment thing again. And we're like second guessing ourselves. But then if you just kind of like completely take the pressure off, you're also like not in a sexual situation. You're like in the kitchen with your partner cooking dinner. And then you're doing this like really playful thing. You just can have so much fun with it.
Exactly. Exactly. And you can start off with sexting. You know, sometimes sexting builds our vocabulary or it allows us to manage rejection in sort of a tamer kind of way. And that rejection might not even just be rejection. It just might be that something didn't quite land for somebody or you called them baby and they like to be called slut or, you know, whatever. It's actually a good way of learning about what words do it for your partner. What words do it for you? I dirty talk a lot of times because it turns me on, because it's taboo, because it's stepping outside my comfort zone. I'm like, oh my God, look at me like doing the thing. Right. So we got to also cheer ourselves on.
Yeah. What are some other, I love that homework, the menu homework, but what are some other things that you kind of like, give people as bits of advice or tips for kind of broaching dirty talk? Because I feel like this is something that it just comes up a lot, like people like in the moment just being like, I don't know what to say.
Like, yeah that's so true. It's in the moment, it's so hard to come up with, okay, what would be sexy right now, or I already told them they're beautiful 54 times, you know, and so we kind of like run out of things to say. So I usually teach 7 different types of dirty talk, and one of the ones that I think is easier to start with for some people find this intimidating. But one type I teach is narration. And so narration is just sort of like looking at what's happening. You like seeing your partner's face between your legs. Babe, you look so hot between my legs. And that's all. And it's not going to land super sexy the first time you try. But after your partner is really affirming, after your partner, you know, moans down there or like lights up because you said something, we want to make sure that we're taking notice of their reaction. If their reaction is kind of muted, you can check in later. You can say, hey, like, did you like that thing? Did you like when I said that? And you can tell them that you're trying and that you'd welcome any of affirmation or any direction on what kind of language does it for them. Being humble and empathetic to other people's pleasure also helps us be humble and empathetic with ourselves, right? And feel like we don't have to say the right thing every single time. So I think narration is a good one because you've got the visual script there for you and that you can just kind of say what's happening. The other thing that I think is good to start with is pick something that you already know your partner does really well. So if your partner spoons you really well, if they kiss your bum really well, if they massage your feet, you're going to ask for something in a sexy way. And so you already know you're going to get it because they already like it. So we take off that rejection. Some people find it really hard to ask for what they want. But if you're asking for something like, babe, can you rub my feet? You just want to slow down that really simple sentence and just lower your voice a little bit. So we're just creating these awkward pauses in our language. And that awkwardness is actually authentic. That pause creates a little bit of tease, right? It creates a little bit of seduction in like, babe, can you rub my feet? You know, like it sounds silly when I'm saying it out of context. It makes us giggle. But when I see someone giggle when I dirty talk, I'm like, cool. I shook something, right? I delighted something.
Yeah. Oh, delighted. Yeah, I love that. And also we shouldn't be afraid of awkwardness.
Ugh, yeah. It is awkward. Sex is awkward. Like, we're not performers, so it's awkward.
Yeah, I love that. It's just like sex is awkward, silly, messy, all of these things.
Yes.
Right, we have some questions from people on Instagram.
Awesome.
They need your help.
Okay, let's do this.
Somebody asked how to explore kinks as someone who doesn't know what theirs are.
Ooh, this is a good one because I think actually a lot of people don't know what their kinks are. I didn't know what my kinks were. And something that can help, I usually don't recommend exploring through porn because porn usually shows a very extreme version of kinks. And it also shows a limited variety of bodies, of gender dynamics, of racial dynamics. So I would actually take yourself to erotic audio or erotic literature and just get curious. Get yourself a glass of wine or a joint or whatever you do to relax and get into just being curious about why is anyone into this and click on that. Why is anyone into that? Or, oh, that's curious, but I don't like it this way. And so you're treating it as a self-discovery because kink also allows you this opportunity for self-development. So I wasn't interested in erotic dominance when I first started exploring my kinks. And out of that feminine dominance, out of teaching it, out of understanding it for myself, playing with it, I actually developed confidence outside of the bedroom by channeling that erotic dominance. So I don't go around doming people non-consensually, but I recognize that, you know, I had trouble receiving. Lots of people have trouble being the receiver. And actually, if you're a people pleaser, you're going to relate to this, you know? And so getting into kind of a curious mode, you might also go online to a sex shop and just look at the different activities or the tools that are there and what's the difference between a riding crop and a cane. Am I interested in rope bondage or handcuffs? And, you know, then take some classes. I think I have taken a million classes. I as soon as I got curious and knew there was even something that called like a sex class, and it really opened me up to different ways of thinking about kink instead of just kind of repeating what I saw other people doing.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And yeah, it's that curiosity thing, especially like, hey, I think I might be interested in kink, but I don't know what's out there. And it's like, go discover.
Yeah.
There's a whole world to explore.
Yes, yes, yes. If you were looking for a pandemic hobby, you know, maybe like searching for your new kink is like the thing.
Yeah. This, I think, is such an interesting question. Somebody asked, tips on unlearning masculinity issues when it comes to sex, especially needing to be dominant, though I want to be submissive sometimes, and I can't be vulnerable and honest about fantasies.
Ooh, yeah. I want to say that both of those things are really hard, and we don't have a society that validates that. And so men also become objectified, and any of us can internalize toxic masculinity or negative forms of masculinity. But particularly for men, there's this expectation that's upheld through society, through our social norms, our sexual norms, that they are in charge and that they are the penetrators, that sex ends when they ejaculate, that sex is always about penetration. And the best thing that I think that can start you on opening up that journey, number one is also taking classes, because I think most pleasure educators are busting this. They're actually creating supportive spaces for exploring things, and they have tools and techniques that can help. I think the second thing is really watching what porn you're looking at. So take stock of is the porn that you're watching, is it reinforcing these norms? Is it validating and creating a pleasure pathway for these same norms? Because what we're trying to do is disrupt, you know, what we've learned is pleasure. And that box that we've learned in is actually not a box. It's a whole sky full of pleasure. And I think the other thing is, like, with your partners to say, hey, you know, I'm kind of curious about what you're into. And so letting someone else's desires, you know, open up space for you to do certain things or engage in certain things. So if this person's interested in submission, find someone who's interested in dominance. So find experiences that are going to be validating. The talking about fantasies thing is really hard because we kind of stumble in and I'm like, oh, so I want to be spanked, you know, and, you know, spanking could be like playful. It could be punishment. It could be reward. It could be part of a disciplinary scene. So we want to get to know that ourselves. So when you're masturbating, or if you want to tell someone about your fantasy, describe it to them as if you were telling a story. So think about your masturbation isn't just you bent over and got spanked. There's a particular tool that you're getting spanked with. What are you wearing? Yeah. What are they wearing? What do you feel? What do they feel? Start answering those questions.
Mm-hmm. Why are you being spanked?
Yes. Why? What did you do? You know?
What did you do?
What kind of naughty were
very,
you?
Very important question. I think what you're saying about porn was so interesting as well, because, yeah, it makes me think about, like, yeah, what are the, like, representations of men and masculinity in a sexual context that you're absorbing? And, like, where can you find more diverse, like, a variety of different kinds of masculinities?
Yes, yes.
As well.
Absolutely. And I think we show up to sex, especially what men are taught, is that they show up to get sex from people. And so that's part of, like, masculinity. So if we show up in our spaces about giving sex, what is the kind of sex that this person wants to receive? That also opens up people's vulnerability and makes it feel safer for us to then be counter vulnerable with them. So if your partner's like, hey, actually, I just want to be eaten out tonight. And you're like, great, you know, let's do that. And is it okay if you tell me what to do? Can you, like, boss me around a little? Because I kind of want to feel like I'm worshiping you tonight. That's an awesome change in the way that we do things.
Yeah. Oh, that's so true. I love that. Well, Luna, thank you so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you. Where can people find more of you online, and, like, all of the work that you do, and, like, you know, all of the classes and webinars and everything that you have?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This conversation was so fun and so amazing. And I hope people got a lot out of it. People can find me at lunamatadas.com. I have about 30 on-demand webinars that you can watch anytime. For people who are also struggling with fantasy language, there is a blog post I have about how to talk about your fantasies and how to vet a potential kinky partner, what questions you should be asking. And you can tune into the Plug Podcast by B-Vibe, which is all about anal pleasure, on wherever you listen to your podcast. And I have some fun things coming up. I have a kinky retreat. Yes. Ooh. Yes. Oh, I know. It's so excited. It's my first retreat ever. I'm doing it with another sex educator, Marla Renee Stewart, and we're calling it Kinky Tapas. So you're getting a lot of kink in little bites. So if you're new to kink, that's happening in April. And actually, this is the first time I'm going to be talking about this on a podcast. I am going to be, I know,
exclusive.
I'm doing it. Yeah. In March, I'm launching an 8-week group online course for sexual confidence in and out of the bedroom. So we're going to be working on untaming all of the nonsense that doesn't serve us, and reclaiming all of the pleasure possibilities that are out there for us. So signing up for my newsletter is the best way to get exclusive access for that.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Yeah, we'll make sure that all of those different things are linked in the show notes. Thank you so much, and thank you all for listening. Bye.
Bye.